Just one announcement before Lai Peng announces. For those on retreat here, please, we have to ban people from laying down in the meditation hall because people are falling asleep and they're snoring, and it means that lots of people are almost getting jhanas and they can't. So please do not lay down in the hall here. If you want to lay down, please lay down in the rooms which are given to you for laying down. They're the laying down rooms, otherwise known as dormitory. Or the other place you can lay down is in the columbarium. And you can lay down there forever. So please, because a few people have complained, there's snoring going on in the afternoon. I'm giving interviews, I'm working hard. So please, in the afternoon or early morning, don't lay down in the meditation hall. Because, of course, many people in the interviews have complained about the same thing. So no laying down. If anybody does break that rule, and they lay down and you fall asleep, I'm sure there's a few empty boxes in this, and I'll put you in one of those, and when you wake up you'll be 6 foot underground. I won't do things like that, but please, no laying down in the hall. Because when you lay down, you may think you're doing laying down meditation, but soon it becomes and it's amazing how loud people can snore. It really is amazing. So please don't lay down in the meditation hall. So remember, what should you not do? Not lay down in the meditation hall. Okay, I think I made that clear enough. Very good. Otherwise it's bad, bad, bad karma. Okay, you can make the announcements now.
I'll make it short this time.
How long is good?
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Wat Shetawan for another night of Dharma Talk by Ajahn Brahmavamsa. We are continuing tonight with the fifth factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, which is jiva or right livelihood. So Ajahn will give a talk for about 1 hour, and then followed by about 30 minutes of questions, taking questions from you. And if you have any questions, please write them down. The box is there. See the red color basket? Come over, pen it down, put it into the box, then we'll move it up to the front for Ajahn to answer after the talk. So we aim to finish about 9:30, 9:35, thereabout. Because the yogis here work very hard. They were so dedicated, diligent, meditating from before 6 a.m. in the morning is holiday time, right? Before 6 a.m., they're already here meditating, and they're still meditating just before the talk starts. So we do want to give them more time to meditate at night, or maybe take a rest. Yeah? Okay, so without further ado, let's put our palms together. Welcome Ajahn to give the talk.
Very good. So they can go to bed early. They won't snore in the meditation. So tonight's talk is the next factor of the Eightfold Path, which is about right livelihood. And many people, they want to be good Buddhists, make good karma, and have a good livelihood. And so sometimes we talk about the wrong livelihoods, but I'm talking about right livelihood first. And so one of the best livelihoods, which I just thought about a minute ago, is being a funeral director. What a wonderful livelihood that is. Just putting people in boxes all day. And being very close to dying and death, because if you're close to dying and death, you don't take this life so seriously. And I've known many funeral directors over in Australia and other countries, because that's one of the things which monks do. You know, we do funeral ceremonies. So you get to know the funeral directors, and they are wonderful people. And they can have some great stories. And so I just was remembering, there's one of the monks I know in Sydney, and he spent many years as a funeral director before he became a monk. What a wonderful preparation that is before you take robes. And he was telling me some of the stories, like there's one cemetery over in Adelaide, and it's, the earth is very, got a high content of clay, and it's also in a hollow, and it's happened many times. They've dug the hole, and they've lowered the coffin into the bottom of the hole, and there happens to be a rainstorm, and it rains very hard, and the water goes into the hole, and being clay, the water's got nowhere to go. So as the hole fills up with water, the coffin rises up. And imagine that, you just buried Uncle George, and then he comes up again. Ah! Oh, one of the other stories he told me, that he was working in Sydney, and there was some of these old apartments in Sydney, and there was one poor old man, the poor old man, who died in the top story. There was an elevator, but the elevator was very small. So usually if you see the funeral directors collect a body, they've got like a little trolley, like the gurneys they use in hospitals. And they put the person on the trolley, but they couldn't fit the trolley in the elevator. This is a true story. So the two of them wondered, what should we do? So the only thing they could do was to hold it vertical. With two of the funeral directors, you know, dressed in black on either side. And they were in the top story, and they were just hoping that they could press the button for going down to the ground floor without being interrupted on the way down. But there's something in the Dhamma called Murphy's Law. If it can happen, it does happen. And sure enough, halfway down, the elevator stopped. Now, this was a very old apartment building, and everybody knew each other in that apartment building. So everybody knew the old fellow at the top had just died. So imagine what happened when when the doors opened, and there's this little old lady on the opposite side. And when she saw this guy who just died standing vertically with his two spooky guys in black on either side, and she screamed. And this is absolutely a true story. They lost hold of this man in the middle, and he started falling towards her. And the poor old lady passed out. And the only thing they could do was to pick the guy up again, go down the bottom, put him in the back of the van, and hurry upstairs to see if they had another customer to bury. But fortunately, the old lady, she was okay. They arrived, they gave her a cup of tea. But that was a true story of the sort of things which happen when you get the right livelihood of being a funeral director. You could have a lot of good fun. But not only that, I just mention funeral directors because, number one, you get close to one of the great truths of life. So a lot of my friends who are Buddhists, actually they volunteer, and that's one of the jobs I like doing. Number one is because every day you see death, and it doesn't make you morbid. This is the trouble with people, they get scared of such things as death. But when you actually live with it and you get close to it, it doesn't make you afraid, it makes you understand the value of life, which means that life becomes more important to you. Everybody who has a close shave with death, had some accident or had a cancer, and you know, sometimes the doctor said 50-50 you survive or not, and you've pulled through. everybody who's come that close to their own death or the death of somebody else always comes out the other end valuing life so much. And the things in life which were once important to them, like money or fame, that's not so important anymore. You know what the things are which are really important? Those are your family, you know, relationships, friend, your spiritual life, your goodness. All the things which we talk about as good karma, they become very clear to you that that is what important when a people does a livelihood like being funeral director. But also, those people who are funeral directors, they don't just bury the bodies or cremate them. They have to deal with the family. So a lot of them do become counselors, even though it's only sort of unofficial counselors, because they're one of the first points of contact with a grieving family, and they have to deal, you know, with making all these decisions and talking with the people who are grieving the loss of someone. They really become very kind and compassionate people. And they can take a people who are grieving and go through this little ceremony as a cremation or a burial and give them a better perspective and allow them to let go. Because the whole part of looking after someone who's dying is to let them go. We can't keep people forever. You know, your mother, your father, they're there. They're really only temporary parents. And your brothers and sisters, they're only temporary brothers and sisters. In Buddhism, because we know that we've had many, many lives, that's so true. Even your wife, she's only temporary wife. But please keep her until she dies and don't get another one. Instead of getting all these mistresses. So, understanding that means you can let people go. And on that particular subject, I know because I get to know all the funeral directors, and I tell them these stories, and they very grateful for the stories which I tell them, especially at funeral services, because they can repeat them themselves to people of other religions. And of course, my favorite story for funerals, and I'm sharing it with you now, so if anyone in your family passes away, this is the one which probably works the most powerfully, and that is my simile of a concert. Because many of you know my biography. You know, I came from a poor home, but I had an amazing father. He was the one who taught me the door of your heart is always, if his heart is always open to me. But he died when I was only 16. And for a man, a young boy, those are the years you really need your father more than anybody. Now, even more than your mother. Now, you're a young man, and he's got the experience. Now, he's the one who you look up to guide you through those years of adolescence. But he died when I was only 16. But the strange thing was that I never felt at all sad when he died. I never cried at his funeral service, and I've never felt sad since. And that was strange. That, you know, a man, a boy, who lost a father he loved very much, did not feel sad. But boys are not very good at understanding their emotions. So it took me many years to figure out how I was feeling. And it was only the opportunity of being a monk with all that time to meditate, to get to know how your mind and your emotional world worked, that I figured out exactly how I felt. Because it was so similar, it was almost exactly the same as another emotion which I was very familiar with. And that was the emotion I always felt at the end of a great concert. Because, you know, I grew up in London. And London was a great place to grow up if you loved music. Because you had all the great bands, and especially the late 60s and 70s. You know, they had the Rolling Stones, which I saw when I was only 11 years of age. And actually, when I saw the Rolling Stones when I was only 11 years of age, I was very upset at you girls. They were screaming and screaming and screaming, and I couldn't hear anything. That's what they used to do in those days. And I always remember going with my brother to a pub in the north of London to see a band. And
Only six of us turned up to listen to this band. Only six, and as soon as I saw there was hardly any audience at all, I really thought that band would not play for us, but they did. It was like a private performance. And the lead singer was Rod Stewart. So, a private performance with Rod. I remember seeing the first concert of Led Zeppelin. The very, very first time they just came together, they were nervous, they were playing all their stuff. So I had a great memories of times, you know, in the 60s and 70s with music. But the one thing I always remember, and apparently it's the same these days, at the end of a concert, everybody stands up, claps and shouts for more. It's called the encore. And they do it these days as well. And after the encore, usually 5 minutes, that everybody, the band has to pack up their instruments and go home. And so did I. I always remember those evenings, going out of the clubs, the concert halls, the pubs of London, and it was always, not like here, where it's nice and warm, always freezing cold, dark, gloomy, and usually raining. You know, in London they can't even do rain properly. It's now half raining, it's the thing called drizzle. Drizzle, just even the name makes you depressed. And you go out after these great concerts in the dark, cold, gloomy, drizzly London night, knowing that the concert had ended. And the chances, I was rational, I was smart, chances of ever seeing that concert again, or the same, was zero. It was over. But never once did I feel sad at the end of a great concert. Never once did I cry at the end of a wonderful performance, even though it was over and it could not be repeated. And I realized that was exactly how I felt at the end of my father's life. It was how I felt when I walked out of the crematorium in Mortlake in West London after my father's cremation. It was raining even then. But I thought, wow, what a wonderful performance that was. How lucky I was to have been there at the time. Thank you, Dad. That was another way of looking at death. It wasn't grieving over what you've lost. It was literally being grateful over what you've had. 16 years. Thank you so much, Dad. And I never ever forgotten those times we had together. In the same way, I never forget the music I heard as a young man. It stays with you forever. So that's another way of looking at life and death. And my goodness, when people hear that, they get moved. This is truth. This is another way. It stops the pain of grief and starts you looking at another way, a way of appreciating and being grateful, of being inspired by life. So being a funeral director, when you can tell stories like that, is a great help and benefit to other people. And because of an example like that, when it gets the right livelihood, you know, sometimes you read in the books that this is right livelihood and that's wrong livelihood, but basically, it's not the livelihood, but how you practice that livelihood makes it right or wrong. So you can't even say that some things are bad and some things are good. Because you can take something like a banker. Is that right livelihood or wrong livelihood? These days in the West, people don't tell people if they're bankers. Because people always blame the bankers for the global financial crises keeping on going. So if anyone actually is a banker, they usually say, no, I'm working business or I work somewhere else. I work in a sandwich store or something. They never actually admit it because they get embarrassed. And banking used to be a very good job. My brother was a banker all his life. And he's a good man. It does not matter really what your profession is, rather than how you practice that profession. So even being a monk, is that right livelihood or wrong livelihood? There are good monks and bad monks. So it really depends on how you do your livelihood makes it good or bad. But of course, the monks you see here, always good livelihood monks. So that's the same with some people. They come to me and they have like jobs in the casino. Now, if you normally look at jobs in the casino, it says straight away, wrong livelihood, bad livelihood, people are gambling, it's a bad thing to do. But ask them what they're doing in the casino. Some of them are actually just counseling, trying to help people with their gambling problems. They will go to the casino anyway. So if that's your job in the casino, that's very, very good. In fact, I think I told a few people earlier that last month, you know where I went last month? I went to Las Vegas. And you know what I did in Las Vegas? I can't tell you. Why? Because what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. But monks have got to be very... Because I say good monks and bad monks, but sometimes I get myself into trouble. There was one occasion when a good friend of mine... He was actually from Malacca. And he said, oh, I've got a friend who's opening up a business. Can you come and bless my friend's business? Now, the trouble is that I'm just so kind. I say, yeah, okay, I'll do that for you. But I forgot to ask what the business was. So when I went to bless his business, it was in a shopping mall. And his business was a lottery outlet. And that's all it does. Sell lottery tickets for the Australian lottery. And it was too late by that time. I was caught. So I did the blessing. And my blessings are very, very powerful. And I forgot about it until this is absolutely true. 2 years later... I was reading the newspaper, which I do read the newspapers to find out what's going on in the world, get some stories from my talks, and also understand how you guys think. And I was looking at the newspaper, and they had an article about this lottery outlet. A big feature. The luckiest lottery outlet in Australia. And it was so, well, so actually famous that people were coming from Singapore and also from KL to buy their lottery tickets from that place because it had the reputation of more people winning from that lottery place than anywhere else in the whole of Australia. And when I saw that, I thought, oh God, what have I done? So monks have got to be very, very careful. Many times people come up to you and they say, Ajahn Brahm, come on, can you give me the numbers? And you know what they always say, we'll give you 5%. And I say, 5%, and I do all the work. But it's strange, it's true. There was a very famous Buddhist nun. I won't say who she is, but this, I checked this story a number of times, all the people involved, this is absolutely true. This is what happens when monks get involved in gambling, or nuns. She was teaching a meditation retreat in England. And when the meditation retreat was over, her driver, who's a good friend of mine, lives in Sydney, was driving her to Heathrow Airport. On the way, they stopped for lunch, you know, before midday. And if you ever go travelling in England, many of the restaurants are right next door to English pubs. So you know, the pubs, they're not sort of places where people go and get drunk. They're just like places where people meet each other. So they do drink alcohol, but not that much. So they had to go through the front of the pub to get to the restaurant. So they went to the restaurant, they had their meal, and the driver had a few English coins left over. And it's a waste of time going to the airport currency exchange to exchange coins. You may have like maybe 10 or 15 pounds of coins. You exchange it for Australian dollars and you're charged commission and you end up having to pay the currency exchange something and you don't get anything back. Because the commission is too much. So you can't do that. So she saw one of these... In Australia, they call them pokey machines, one-armed bandits. You know that thing where you actually, that's what they used to call them. What do they call them in Malaysia? Jackpot. Well, jackpot machine. So she just put the coins in there, just trying to get rid of the coins and pulling the handle. Nothing happened. Another coin, pull the handle. She just, this is the driver, not the nun. The nuns don't do this, they don't know. And she just put a coin in the slot, the driver, when the nun walked by. She just finished her lunch. And the driver, this lady Anya, her name is, said, "Aya, you have all the good karma. You pull the handle." And just in a moment, a lapse of mindfulness, just being kind, you pull the handle, not really thinking, just had a good lunch, just walking past, the Buddhist nun pulled the handle. And what do you think happened next? This is absolutely true. You could not make it up. All the numbers went around, and it was, as you know, jackpot. And all monks, even nuns, were not allowed to touch money. And all this money was covering her, coming out of the machine. Hundreds, thousands of pounds were coming out. And this was in the front of the pub. And all the people in the pub went quiet. Totally silent. As they saw this strangely dressed Buddhist nun winning the jackpot. And then the man serving the drinks behind the bar rang the bell. Ding, ding. Do we got a bell here? No, it's gone. I can't do any special effects. The bell's disappeared. That's okay. He rang the bell. And then he announced to the nun. In England, there are many traditions. And people keep those traditions. Because the tradition was, if you won the jackpot, you had to buy 3 round of drinks for everybody in the pub. So that was the first time in 2600 years since the time of the Buddha that a Buddhist nun had to buy whiskies, gin and tonics, and beers to 40 or 50 people, and she could not escape from that. So that's the trouble when monks and nuns get involved in that business. We keep on winning. That's the trouble. We get embarrassed. So that's why, as a monk or nun, you really don't get involved in gambling at all. Even if you do know the numbers and you can pull the lottery things, don't do it. You get in big trouble. So anyway, it goes to gambling. Is gambling wrong livelihood? Of course it is, because all gamblers lose, every one of them. But we think, no, we can beat the odds. If you're a monk or a nun, you can beat the odds, but you can't touch the money, so it doesn't really work. But all people think that they can beat the odds somehow or other, so they go to Buddhist temples, lucky temples. And they get the incense, and because, again, they were taught by their grandmother, they shake the incense, wishing for good luck from the whoever's there, and then they go to the temple. And it reminds me of this one story of this man, and he was a good man, but then when he was just having a day off, he actually heard a sound. And he wasn't schizophrenic, he actually heard this. The sound was in his ear saying, "Go to the casino." And first of all, he thought he was just imagining it. But it said it again. "Go to the casino. I can help you." And it was so clear, and he never usually hears this, he really thought it must be, you know, his recently deceased father trying to give him a hand with his finances. So, what did he do? He had the afternoon off, he went to the casino. And as he got in the casino door, he heard the voice again, "Go to the roulette wheel. Go to the roulette wheel." So, of course, what do? He went to the roulette wheel. And then, when he was sitting by the roulette wheel, he heard the voice say, "Put $10 on number 16. $10 on number 16. So it's only 10 bucks. He put it on number 16. The croupier put the ball in the wheel, turned it around, went round and round, and it fell on number 16. He took all the winnings, which is quite a lot. And that's when he heard the voice say again, put all the winnings on number 22. All the winnings on number 22. And he put all the winnings on 22. The croupier put the ball in, span the wheel, it went round and round and fell in number 22. And he could hear by this time, whoever was talking to him, say, yeah, woo-hoo, great. Put all the winnings on number 17. Put all the winnings on number 17. And this was maybe $100,000 already on number 17. But he heard the angel say this, so he did it. And he put it on number 17. He was really, his heart was pounding. He was really excited because this is, you know, if this had won, he would be able to retire. And it was psychic voices, and people believe supernatural voices. He put the ball in the croupier put the ball in the wheel, turned it around, it went round, it fell in number 17. And then bounced out to the number next door. And that's when he heard the voice. He heard the voice very carefully. Oh shit. Oh shit. Because even heavenly beings make mistakes. So don't believe anybody just because it's supernatural. Supernatural beings make mistakes too. So, when it comes to gambling, people always lose. So don't take that as a profession. And the professions which are good professions and are professions when you can really help people. It's not really the job you do, but how you do the job, which is what matters in life. And sometimes people look for a profession where they can really make a difference, where they can do something for this world. But sometimes, and people think that, you know, professions like being a bus driver or a street sweeper or something like that, you can't do very much. But that is wrong. In all professions, you have the opportunity to actually to create some happiness with other people. It's how you do the job. When I was going from taken again to Heathrow Airport after I was giving talks there a couple of years ago. On the way, we saw one of these ladies who was stopping the traffic to let the children go across. In England, we call them lollipop ladies because the stop sign is like this big circle on the end of a stick, like a lollipop. And this one morning, I'm not quite sure if the lollipop lady was on heroin or speed, but she was actually dancing with her lollipop, and she was making everybody happy and laughing on the way to work. And I thought, what wonderful livelihood that is, giving that little bit extra so that in the morning people going to work, oh my goodness, stuck in the traffic, she saw somebody, an ordinary person on the side of the road dancing for joy. And thereby giving people some fun and happiness in the first part of the morning. And that was one of the examples I always like to quote about, even if you've just got this mundane, ordinary job of helping children across the road, talking to the children, being kind to them, taking an interest in them, that makes a simple job right livelihood. It's how you do the job rather than the nature of the job. Is the most important part of right livelihood. So many of you have got your careers, and sometimes, as many of you have asked me during the interviews, I don't like my job. There's lots of people don't like their jobs, and the reason you actually get paid is actually to bribe you to do something you don't like. Who likes getting up on a Monday morning to go to work? Who likes going to the office and having to face all this paperwork and computers and people? Work is always hard. If you really enjoyed your work, really enjoyed your work, tell your boss and he will stop paying you. So remember that the money is a bribe to do something you'd rather not do. But you can always make your work fun. my work. You think being a monk is good fun. Is it? Having to listen to all your problems in the afternoon. Here we go again. And sometimes people tell me their marriage problems. I haven't been married. I became a monk to escape all of that. And I can't escape it. You tell me your problems. But, you know, one of the worst things of being a monk, I caught myself getting negative when I was over in Indonesia early this year, was having your photograph taken. And I think, why are they taking photographs of me? I am not a hot monk. I am not drop-dead gorgeous. I am not some soccer star who plays in the EPL. I'm only an old monk. I'm over 60 now. What are you doing? But it's okay, one or two. But I was in, I think it was in Medan or somewhere, and people were lining up 2 hours of taking photographs of me. And after a while, the smile gets a bit sore. So I thought, I never became a monk to do this. But in the end, what I remember doing is to tell myself, look, this is, no, it's tough doing this, but I'm going to make fun with it. So these days, you see, even though it's not really in my job description as a monk, still I will let you do it, and I will enjoy myself because I put joy into what, you know, I would rather not do. To the point, I have fun as well. And that is the trick of right livelihood. No matter what you have to do in the office, in the workplace, please put joy into it and make it right livelihood. Put kindness into it and make it right livelihood. Whatever it is. Now, being a policeman is one of the worst jobs you can probably do. Do you like policemen? If a policeman, you see a policeman coming behind you, well, how do you feel? What am I doing wrong? I must be doing something wrong. But did you see in the newspapers a couple of weeks ago that policeman in New York who stopped by a homeless man in the cold, brought him a pair of boots with his own money, and put the socks on this homeless man and gave him this pair of boots, and some tourist happened to have one of their mobile phones and took a video of it, uploaded it onto YouTube, and it went viral. You know, a really nice cop who wasn't arresting people or trying to find out what was they were doing wrong, was really looking out for people. And if you've ever been to New York, you know how cold it is this time of the year. And that a New York cop would, from his own money, buy a pair of boots for somebody he didn't know just because he was cold and homeless. That is right livelihood. And everybody has the opportunity to do that in your work, no matter what that work happens to be. You always have the opportunity to be kind and do something a little bit more than is required of you. And that turns everything, any job, into right livelihood. When I was visiting UK once, I was invited to a seminar run by the British Army. And I thought, this is interesting. I've never done this before. I wonder what they're going to ask me to do. And it was, when I went there, it was, there's many members of the British Army are Buddhists. And they had a seminar to actually just look after them. And when I went there, I thought, these soldiers, or these people in the army, they can't be frontline troops. That must be wrong livelihood, carrying a gun and shooting people. That's what I heard in the books. One of the wrong livelihoods said in the suttas is being in a soldier, being in the army. So I thought these would be the support staff, you know, the dentist, the people who taught the soldiers' children, the accountants. But I was so surprised to see that most of the people who came on this course were frontline soldiers who did carry big guns in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I thought, how can you be Buddhists when you're in the army with wrong livelihood? That's how I thought, and I was the one who was wrong. Because you always have an open mind as a Buddhist. You don't just judge people because the book says this or that. And then they started, I had a really wonderful conversation with them. How do you do this? And they started telling me that, you know, that they believed in what they were fighting for. They thought they were fighting for, you know, the freedom of these countries, to actually to make sure the terrorists don't plant bombs in countries even like Malaysia or Singapore, certainly not in Europe. And, you know, those terrorist bombs, they do kill lots of people, and it's very, causes a huge amount of suffering and pain. So they really wanted to try and stop these terrorists. And when they told me how they behaved, and they were honest about this, I thought, I'd rather have a Buddhist as a soldier than someone with no religion, someone with no compassion, someone with no restraint. They were really curbing their anger. They were really restraining themselves and being very highly disciplined. And I thought, my goodness, maybe that can be right livelihood after all. Even as a soldier, it's not so much your job you do, but how you perform that job, how kind you are, how restrained you are, that is what makes it right livelihood. So that really opened my eyes to another way of looking at life. Because sometimes you think even ordinary professions, just like, you know, working for the government, that is right livelihood. Is it right livelihood, working for the government? I got another story which puts this into perspective. There was one lady I knew who worked for the government in England, and she got a bit bored working for the government with all the office politics and backbiting and people, you know, trying to sort of get their promotion at the expense of other people. You know what it's like working in big offices. So she volunteered to be a social worker in some refugee camp in Africa. There's always famines or wars there. So she just took 6 months long service leave off to volunteer. And she volunteered to do anything. So when she arrived at this refugee camp somewhere in Africa, the head of the refugee camp gave her this job, which you would think would be the worst job in the whole world. Her job was to go outside of the compound early in the morning with a number. That was the number of people she would let in. Many refugees arrived the night before. The camp was closed. They would allow so many people in, because that's all the resources they had. They couldn't look after everybody. And she knew that these were people on the edge of death. And most of the people she never let in would die in the next 24 hours. She was literally choosing who was going to live and who would die. And you think that's a terrible job, but she said that actually it was one of the most inspiring times of her life. Because those refugees who came the night before, when they realized that not all of them could come inside and the rest would die, they were so selfless. They would never say, take me, take me. They say, take her, she's got a child. No, take him, he looks after his family. And she said it was so uplifting to see in the most desperate times of this famine, where people were literally dying, still people weren't thinking of themselves, but they were practicing compassion and selflessness. And that's why she said that was one of the most inspiring experiences of her life, to work in that camp. Even though people say it's playing God, she said, no, other people made that choice for me. That became for her a shining example of right livelihood. And when she went back to work in the government offices, she said, this is really depressing now. This is wrong livelihood. Even though that you're not really harming anybody with your work, it's the way you do the work harms other people. So look, if you are working in an office, you are working as a bus driver, it's what you do to the people who come into your bus, that's what makes it right livelihood or wrong livelihood. So even bus drivers, sometimes they can smile at you and wish you, how are you today, to give that little bit of extra kindness. Doesn't that really make a difference? And my goodness, it does. So you can turn the most simple jobs into kindness, into right livelihood. So in your lives, you get huge job satisfaction when you give such kindness to other people. That's why it's called inspiration. That's why it's called right livelihood. It's the way you use your job, whatever it happens to be in life, to give that little bit extra to people so that it does become right livelihood. And I don't care what the job is, you can make it wrong livelihood if you exploit other people and if you just do the bare minimum, if you're upset or angry or whatever else you do in life. So remember, that is the difference between right livelihood and wrong livelihood. It's how you do the job. Obviously, some jobs are easier to make it right livelihood than wrong livelihood. Now, things like, we always think that medicine, being a doctor, being a nurse, that must be right livelihood. That's simply because you're curing people. But is it right livelihood? I remember a young guy who, and I'd known since he was very small, his mother brought him to my temple when he was small, and I saw him grow up. Any problems he had, he'd always come to me for counseling, and he became a doctor, a very smart guy. And when he was doing his intern year, he came to see me one evening. He was very distraught, because what had happened, he'd lost his first patient. There was a young woman, I think, a young woman under his care had died, and he had to break the news to her husband to tell this man that his kids had no mother, he had no wife. She died. And even though he was a good doctor, you know, people always feel guilty when this happens. They always feel, maybe I could have done more. And he said, I feel so much a failure. And he was considering quitting there and then. You can imagine what he must have felt like. And I had to counsel him and tell him, if you think that your purpose as a doctor is to cure people, you will feel this same emotion of failure again and again and again. Because many of the people under your care will die. So if you think your purpose as a doctor is to cure people, you will always be a failure. And that's not necessary, because the purpose of a doctor is not to cure, but to care. Please care for your patients, not cure for them. And then you never need to feel a failure. You may not be able to keep them alive, but you'll always be able to care for them. And he got it straight away. And he went back to work and became a wonderful doctor. Many of his patients died. But those who died, died knowing they were cared for. Now, have you ever seen people on the edge of death in hospitals, having all this stuff put into them, having so much intervention at the very last, as the doctors and nurses desperately try and keep them alive at all costs? And sometimes many people quite justifiably feel appalled. Why can't you just let them go? They're dying. And it's because in modern medicine, curing is more important than caring. It's the wrong way around. We don't want to care for a person, we want to cure them at all costs. Imagine if caring became more important than curing. Then when it gets to that point, you're dying and there's very little chance that we're going to keep you alive. You'll be cared for in your last moments, instead of trying desperately all these interventions trying to get you alive again. Wouldn't that be a much more wonderful way of doing medicine in our hospitals? Certainly I would say yes. When I get sort of to that stage, I don't want people rushing around and trying to stuff this up my nose and that down my my throat and injecting me with all this. I want to die peacefully. Shut up. Leave me alone. I'm meditating. So if you remember as a doctor or as a nurse, as a psychologist, as a counselor, that your job, main job, is to care for people, not to cure them, then you become a far more effective doctor, nurse, or whatever else is your profession in that area. Remember, caring is more important than curing. And number two, this is only how I feel, my anecdotal experience, that you will cure more people if you put caring at the top and curing secondary. Too many times we intervene because we're not caring for a person. We're not nurturing their emotional strengths and they die anyway. So please, if you are in the hospital profession, please remember caring is always more important than curing. And then you will be right livelihood in your profession, rather than wrong livelihood, creating more pain. Because that is essentially what right livelihood and wrong livelihood is. What is the effect of what you're doing? Are you creating more peace and happiness in this world? Or are you creating more problems and more suffering in this world? If it's the former, more happiness, that becomes right livelihood. If it's the latter, it is wrong livelihood, no matter what it is you're doing in life. And remember, even if you have no work to do, there's so many societies and communities need your help. So you can do voluntary work, and that is sometimes wrong livelihood. It depends how you do it again, because you can be a volunteer, and I know this, because some volunteers in my society, they drive me crazy. The reason why they are free is because they're hopeless. If they were any good, they'd have a job. So that's one of the troubles, voluntary work. You get all these losers and hopeless cases who come and volunteer for you because they can't get a job anywhere else. But nevertheless, I care for them. We try and nurture them to make sure that they can do something which is really good for them. And as a monk, whenever I have to give a job for the monks who work for me, you know, these are the chores we give in monasteries. You always try and give a job which people can do. And when they do the job, I never look over their shoulder and tell them how it's done. If you're a manager, I don't know how bad managers are these days. People always complain about them, and probably there's quite a few managers here. You complain about your boss, but you're probably a boss to many others, and they probably complain about you as well. So even in the world of being a boss and being a manager, please change your management style to right livelihood rather than wrong livelihood. And what do I mean there? Please be kind to the people who work under you. Now listen to them. Give them proper instructions, number one, because that's the worst thing when a boss gives you a job to do and they don't explain what it is you want to do. So please be clear. Now, that happened to me many times. What do you want me to do? I've already told you. No, you haven't. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. A lot of times people just don't know what to do, which is why they don't perform. Give them clear instructions. And number two, don't always be looking over their shoulder, criticizing them. I know this. When I give jobs to some of the monks in my monastery, I can do it much better than they can. You understand what I mean? But no, you've got to let your workers do it their way. And when they do something, always praise them. Well done, even though you have to grit your teeth when you say, well done. Because if you don't encourage them, then they'll lose their motivation the next time they do a job. I'm not bothering this boss of mine. Blah, blah. And they deliberately do a bad job. So make sure you encourage them, even though it's a stretch to be able to say that without breaking your fourth precept line. Encourage them, because then every time they do the job better. That's why every time my favorite word, very good, I know very good in many languages, Bagus, Bagus Sakali, Bahoma Hondai, D-Mark, I know Veldibra, that's even Norwegian. So you can ask Ajahn Bamani next time he comes. I know very good in many languages. I only know very bad in one language, and that's English. So you be a manager like that. And then people like working for you. They volunteer because you're a good boss. You encourage them. You motivate them. And then in your work, you can make it right livelihood. So with right livelihood, it's a little bit to do with what you do. But it's mostly to do with how you do it in life. And no matter what job you have, if you're a housewife, if you're a mother, if you're a bus driver, if you're the prime minister, it's how you do the work. That is really the most important. Not the job. What you make of the job makes it right livelihood. So thank you for listening to Right Livelihood. Sadhu. Okay, questions please. Very good. Very good. Here we go, there are questions. Oh, there's not that many today. Goodness gracious. Or is there? Yeah, some more. Very good. Here we go. Is a comedian right livelihood? Somebody said, the Buddha actually said that being a comedian is wrong livelihood. And I'm really stuffed. How do you praise a wife who always likes to say, no money, no love, no money, no honey? You tell your wife, if you don't give me any money, I won't love you. Tell your wife, if you don't give me money, I'll find another honey. Turn it around and say that to your wife. Because in today's world, we have equity. So sometimes the woman goes to work. You tell your wife, look, I've been working for you such a long time, I'm retiring now, now you go to work. And if you don't give me any money... No, come on. With a relationship, this is what I keep telling people when I marry them. That you look at the husband, first of all, the new husband, the groom. I look him in the eyes and said, look, from today on you're a married man. Once you're married, you must never think of yourself. That's important in marriage. You're married. It's like doing things together. So you mustn't be selfish. And he always agrees. And I now look at the wife and say the same to her. From this day on, you're a married woman. You mustn't think of yourself either. And still looking at the new wife, I say, from this moment on, now you're married, you mustn't think of him, your husband. And looking at the husband, I say, and you mustn't think of your wife from this moment on. And I always love the look of absolute confusion. Reading their minds and say, who is this crazy monk marrying us? And then, I'm sure you've heard this before, but the solution to that riddle is, once you're married, you must never think of yourself, nor must you think of your partner. The solution is, you must always think of us. That's different. Thinking of the other person, we call that a Mahayana marriage. Thinking of yourself is a Hinayana marriage. Both don't work. Think of us. You're in it together. And it's amazing that when people see that, they get the secret of a marriage. Look, it's not about me. It's not about you. It's always about us. A marriage is in it together. If you get that from the very beginning of your married life and your relationship, you understand the secret of a happy marriage. It's not about demanding things of each other. It's demanding things of us. And if there is any problem, whose problem is it? Our problem, yeah. It's never his problem. It's never her problem or my problem. It's always our problem. If you get that right from the beginning, you will have a very happy time together. But if you forget that and you think it's me and you're selfish, or you sacrifice yourself like many of you women do, then you soon get burnt out and this is what happens. Get it right from the beginning. It's all about us. Not about you. Not about me. when I talk like this, a lot of women say, oh, what a shame Ajahn Brahm was a monk. He'd make a wonderful husband. Too late. Dear Ajahn, how do I perform the right livelihood when the company is not rewarding staff with good bonus increment, even though the company is profiting? Because working for money is only part of right livelihood. It's what you're doing and recognizing you're doing a service to the community. No, even funeral directors, they do a service to the community. I want to be buried or cremated and looked after when I go, and I need funeral directors. I do need policemen to keep me safe. I do need lawyers to make sure that, you know, whenever we buy any land or build something for the monastery, it's all done legally. Every job which you have, even the people who make the toilet paper, you're really important to me because I use that every day. So whatever job you have in life, remember the service which you are giving to the community. And when you realize that you are not just making money, you're actually part of the service which keeps this community as it is, then you feel that your job is valuable. And number two, you're working with other people. So form that friendships with other people. Where you work is like a microcosm of society. It's a group. It's like a family. That family can be dysfunctional, where people are always backbiting and arguing with each other. But it doesn't have to be that way. You can be the person who's a peacemaker, who takes an office and transforms it into a loving, caring little group where people are looking out for each other, where you can invite people home to dinner, you get to know each other, socialize each other, and give another level of support for when people are in trouble. You know, someone in your office, you know, may have lost their sister in a car accident, and you can actually look after them because you're their friend. And so when we start to practice compassion and service, you know, to the people in our office, we can turn that into right livelihood. So you're not getting much money, but you're getting job satisfaction. And that turns it into right livelihood. And hopefully, that when you become the big boss, then you never do what these big bosses are doing today and just be selfish and try and screw as much money as you can out of the customers, not to give bonuses to the people who do all the hard work. And you realize, just like a marriage, it's not about me and him or her, it's all about us. A company is the same. Even the smallest worker in the company counts. It's all just, you know, one group of people working together. And if you have a company motto and ethos like that, it's not about me or him or her, it's about us, your company will be very, very successful. So you can turn it into right livelihood. No matter how much money you get in the company, it's never enough. Do you get paid enough? Put your hands up if you get paid enough. Yeah, okay. Come on, put your hand up. You can pay enough, yeah. Okay, very good. Now then, are farmers the right livelihood? And does the grass have any consciousness? All those cows killing the grass. Cows are murderers. If grass has consciousness and grass is a living being, all those cows, you know, they're not. What about you if you eat a carrot? You murderer. You know what a vegetarian is. You know what a humanitarian is? If a vegetarian is someone who eats vegetables, a humanitarian is someone who eats humans. I can't avoid that. One of my favourite jokes. Didn't I tell the carrot joke the other day? No, I think I told the carrot joke over in Melbourne. There were two carrots. This is a vegetarian's joke. Two carrots were walking in one of the streets in KL on Christmas. And there was some drunken person, because a lot of people are drunk at Christmas time here in KL. Some drunken person driving a car lost control of their vehicle and hit one of the carrots. And the other carrot got out his mobile phone, rang for the ambulance. What's the number for the ambulance here? 999, rang 999. And the ambulance, even though it was Christmas, came within a couple of minutes, just as well, because that cat was very badly injured. They put the carrot into the back of the ambulance, and his friend went with him to the hospital. They went straight into the emergency room. The triage nurses took one look at the injured carrot and put him straight into surgery. It was a matter of life and death. And if ever you've been to hospital, in the emergency department, in the waiting room, there's probably never a more tense place than in a waiting room of the emergency department of hospitals. Family members or friends are waiting there, knowing that the people they love are on the edge of life and death. And the healthy carrot was waiting there for 2 hours before the surgeon came in to tell the news. The surgeon said, "I've got some good news and bad news for you. Your friend, Mr. Carrot, the good news is he's going to survive. We've kept him alive. The bad news is, because of his injuries, he's going to be a vegetable for the rest of his life." That's one of the worst jokes, but it's very funny. I just love telling it. So are farmers the right livelihood? It's if the farmer has to kill the cow, then no. So there's farmers who do dairy farming, vegetable farming. It depends the type of farming. Like anything else, it's how you do the job rather than actually the job you do. So maybe the farmer can actually tell the cow and give, you know, maybe get the cow to commit suicide or something, I don't know. Maybe give the cow the gun and say, "Look, I can't do this, do it yourself." But no, like farmers, if you've ever killed an animal, I don't know about you, I've only ever killed one animal in my life, or responsible for one, killing one animal. I remember when, just after my father died, there was a mouse in my mother's apartment. And I don't know why women are terrified of mice, but she was. And so I decided to be the man of the house and catch the mouse for her. I put a trap out, and I was always very successful in whatever I did, unfortunately. And I caught the mouse. And when I actually saw that dead mouse, I stroked it. It was such a beautiful animal. And I stroked its fur, was so soft. And I thought, "Oh God, what have I done?" And I felt so terrible. I can even visualize it today. Just a little mouse I felt so terrible about. And this is what happens when you personally kill something. And the bigger the animal, the worse you feel. It's just instant karma. So that was the only animal I've been responsible for killing. I don't want to do that again. So if you are a person who ever kills something once, look at that animal, look at it, feel it. You'll only do it once, you'll never do it again. Because it is bad karma killing. And does grass have any consciousness? Not that I know of. I've actually stood on grass many times. I've never heard it scream or say, "Get off!" What is four-faced Buddha? What is the significance and why do devotees pray to them? That's not a Buddha. Buddha's only got one face. He was just that one over there's only got one face. This is like the Erawan statue. It's more like Hinduism. I think it is a Hindu god, isn't it? It's not actually a Buddhist thing at all, but sometimes all these things get confused and mixed up, so people don't know what they're doing. So it's a waste of time praying to. That's why I tell people that if, for example, if you are praying, "May that girl fall in love with me because I love her," then the best thing to do is not to pray to a statue, not to give donations to the temple. Just brush your teeth, get rid of your body odor, wear a nice suit, groom yourself, and then she might fall in love with you. You've got much more chance doing it that way. If you've got bad breath, all the praying in the world won't get her to go out with you. Dear Ajahn Brahm, you mentioned universes come and go and many big bands. Question, who or what created human beings, the first human beings? Nothing created human beings. Human beings evolved. Everybody knows that. And some of you are more evolved than others. And we're constantly evolving. So this is just what happens, that we come, we can see just the whole idea of a species. Being a scientist, I remember reading the biography of the scientist Linnaeus. I think he was Dutch, I think. And he was a person who started the idea of species. A very brilliant man. And there's all these different animals and birds and fish, you know, in our world. And he wanted to classify them. And he had a method of classifying all these different animals and into species. And he, being a scientist, was very rigorous and methodical, except when he came to the last three types of animals: chimpanzees, gorillas, and human beings. And according to his method, they should be in the same species. There was no difference between them. Unfortunately, at that time, if he had put human beings in the same category as chimpanzees and gorillas, no one would have taken his research seriously. So he said in his biography, that's the one time he stopped being a scientist and became a politician. So he did what worked rather than, you know, what was true. And he always regretted that. But when I read that, how true that is. We are the same species as chimpanzees and gorillas. Don't get too ahead of yourselves. That's why I love bananas. So the first human being, we just evolved. Does Buddhism support evolution, and to what extent? E.g. humans, yeah, evolved from apes, of course we do. Is Earth the only place inhabited by human beings? Can human beings be found in other parts of the universe according to Buddhist cosmology? Which sutta relates to this? Yes, there is one sutta here. And it's in the Anguttara Nikaya, which says there are other universe systems. In those other universe systems, there are other suns and moons and planets with other beings on them. Yes, there are aliens. And they're walking among us now. Will all the aliens please stand up? No, I know there are aliens. Have you ever been to Heathrow Airport? I went there once. I've got a British passport. So I went in the EU citizens lane. And there's another lane there. It says aliens. And I was looking in there for people with tentacles and bug eyes. I can never see it. It's true, they got it there. So yeah, there are aliens. That makes you interesting. Have you ever seen an alien? Does noble silence mean we're not even allowed to smile? No. Please smile. Smile as much as you can. So, but noble silence doesn't mean it's silence, okay? No snoring in the hall. That's ignoble. Dear Ajahn Brahm, so please smile at one another, make people happy, it's okay to do that. Dear Ajahn Brahm, is there a difference between the mind and consciousness? There are six different types of consciousnesses, and they are all different. Seeing, hearing, smelling, this is a serious question. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting and touching, and mind consciousness. The reason, why is it, do you think, that seeing has something in common with hearing, something in common with smelling, tasting and touching? There's something in common between those five senses. And what is common, as soon as you see something, the mind knows you've seen. As soon as you hear, the mind knows you've heard. It knows you've smelt, it knows you've tasted, it knows you've felt something with your body. And also, as soon as you know something, the mind knows that it knew. That is the nature of the mind. It follows on after every conscious experience. And that gives consciousness the illusion of similarity, that you are always conscious. You are not always conscious. These different consciousnesses arise and fall every moment. I developed what I call, what my monks call, the fruit salad simile. The fruit salad simile is this. Seeing is like an apple, you know, the apple of the eye. And it's not really fruit because ears. I said cauliflower because, you know, we have the word like a cauliflower ear if somebody punches you. Nose, banana. taste, mango, because I like mangoes. And body, what do I use for body? Pineapple. Oh, you know that simile, very good. And lastly, mind consciousness, coconut. So those are the six types of fruit. You know, and the apple represents seeing, cauliflower hearing, banana smelling, mango tasting, pineapple touching, and lastly, coconut means knowing, mind consciousness. And what happens is like you have an apple on your plate, and it immediately disappears and replaces by a coconut. And then a banana appears, followed by a coconut. Maybe then another banana, a coconut. Then a cauliflower and coconut. What's happening is you're seeing something, then you're smelling, then hearing. But when one fruit disappears, then the other one comes. This is actually the nature of consciousness. One sense consciousness arises, it disappears, followed by mind consciousness, disappears, followed by another sense consciousness, disappears. That is actually consciousness. It flows so fast that just like that little toy of like the frames of pictures, like a walking man, and they're just drawing, and you flip them, and it appears like this continuous motion. The old movies, which were just one frame after another, which went so fast, it gave the impression of movement. That is just the illusion of consciousness. Consciousness is momentary. It moves so fast, it appears to be a flow. And we think that we are the one who is conscious. When you actually see it for what it is, you see it's just moments of different consciousnesses. There's no one there. Just an empty process. Ooh-hoo. So this is actually seeing the six different types of consciousness. And when you find out that when you get into the deep meditations, you've only got mind consciousness left. Once you recognize the coconut, then you can actually see the illusion. That it's banana, coconut, apple, coconut, apple, coconut. But once you recognize what the coconut is, mind consciousness with nothing else, and everything else becomes quite clear. That's one of the reasons why we do these jhanas, to get pure mind consciousness, know what that one is, and then everything else unravels. What is the Buddhist view on the secret, also known as the law of attraction? Do Buddhists believe in placing an order to the universe to get what we want? Oh my goodness. If it was that easy. The great thing about the secret was the fellow who wrote it has made a fortune. He is a smart fellow, and everyone who bought that is not smart. I read a little bit of that just to see what people were believing in. When you go to the shopping mall, you just got to imagine the parking space. Imagine the parking space. Imagine it's there. When you get there, it's there. It doesn't work. Imagine there's a check in your mailbox. Imagine it's there. Imagine it's there. And then suddenly it's there. It doesn't work. There is always an element in truth there. If you really aspire for it and work for it, you've got a good chance of getting it. But you've got to keep it in reason. I know many guys who read that book and say, Angelina Jolie, Scarlett Johansson. I know she's going to marry me. I can visualize her. That's the easy thing to do for a guy. It doesn't work. You've got to be rational. There's no way in the world that Scarlett Johansson's going to go out with you. So look, be reasonable. But the thing is, it panders to people's wishful thinking. They want so much, and when it gives you a way to get what you want, people believe in it. Why meditation doing nothing brings good merits? Thank you. Because it's so still, so peaceful, you get power. So whatever you do afterwards, meditation is like the gas in your engine. So if you've got no gas in the engine, even if you want to go and take people here and take people there, you won't be able to do it. So the meditation enables you to be kind,
to be generous, to serve. It gives you the power. That's why it's the greatest merit. There we go. The next question. Dear Ajahn, in this morning sitting, I reached stillness. In a short time, without any stray thoughts, I felt like coming back home, so comfortably cradled in my late mother's arms, tears rolling down uncontrollably. Then I got more stable emotionally. Still I saw lights, sometimes shining from top, sometimes in front, sometimes surrounding me. Is this nimitta? I sat through 1.5 hours. The whole session was as if watching a 3D movie. I closed my eyes, but adjusting position twice, so I kept focusing on the movie. Am I on the right track? Thank you for my compassion and guidance. When people hear that, they think, oh, I wish I could do that. It makes you so jealous. Now, I should actually mention, when I talk like I did this morning, it's important that I tell you what can happen in meditation. But please don't let that be a source of craving. Sometimes when I say these amazing things, people can't help themselves. I want, I want, I want, I want. And then that just destroys your meditation. So please, when I do teach like that, remember the way to achieve these nice states is to let go, not to crave. If you crave, you're going to miss it. So it's wonderful. Yes, that's the sort of stuff which happens. And you can sit for long periods of time having a great time. It's not the best of the nimittas, but it's a good one. So well done. So that's what happens. Another question is coming in. I won't. Here we go. See, it does work. Some people get it. And if they can, so can you. And imagine that, you know, that's one of your best friends. You feel really upset. Hey, she got meditation. I've been coming here for years and I've never got anything. This is her first retreat. This is really unfair. What is the meaning of emptiness? Do we need a certain level of wisdom to understand this word? And I heard of the instance where the bowl of Siddhartha Gautama fought against the current of the river before his enlightenment due to the strong determination. Was it true? If it was, how was that possible based on science? Or maybe science just cannot explain everything. Of course science can't explain everything. There's many strange things which happen in our world. I haven't told many ghost stories. But one of my favorite ones happened just a year or two ago. And that was a story of the lady in, she was Sri Lankan. And she got so sick that her family got enough money together to send her to Singapore. But even though she had the best medical care, he was dying. And his sister, towards the very end, called me in Perth and said, can you please talk to my brother? He's only got a few days to go, and it'll be wonderful if I can give him some advice. And even though it was my retreat time, I agreed. For 2 evenings I spoke to him. I had to do most of the talking because he was so weak, he could hardly speak. And the third night he died. And the fourth night his sister gave me a call to tell me he had died, but also to tell me a strange, spooky thing had happened. He died the night before. 12 hours after he had died, he sent his sister an email saying thank you. That's all the email said. An email from beyond death. And this is a true story. And there was no way he could have typed in that email and actually programmed it to be sent sometime afterwards, because he was paralyzed for about a few weeks before his death. He couldn't do anything. And 12 hours afterwards, he could send the email. I always wondered, because I'm a monk, I don't know too much about this stuff. I always wondered what Gmail meant. Ghost mail. So, if your mother
or auntie or someone has died, please check your email. Gmail, Ghostmail, yeah. So yeah, there is some weird stuff which happens in life which science can't really say. And what is the meaning of emptiness? This is when there's nothing there. You go deep inside and the bus driver's seat is empty. No consciousness. Just nothing left. Wow. That's why, again, you can call a good monk. What is my title? Your emptiness is. So that's a very good title. But you'll hear more about that later on when we do some more stuff on insight. Is there a quick way to handle our body after we die? Burial, cremation, organ recycling. It doesn't matter after you die. You just let someone else worry about that. So you can do whatever you want with it. Me, you know that my favorite way of dying would be in aircraft explosion. And I fly so often, there's a good chance that might happen. And remember what I said last time? I said this in the BGF many times. The three benefits of dying in aircraft explosion at 36,000 feet. Remember that? Yes. So if you ever see a terrorist going on board your flight, yes. The first benefit, remember, instant cremation. Don't have to organize anything. Very quick, on the spot, very efficient. Number two, you don't have to pay any money to cremate your grandma. You know, not only is it done for free, you also get payoff. You actually make money out of her death from insurance. And lastly, if you die in an aircraft explosion at 36,000 feet, you're so close to heaven, you can go the rest of the way easily. So that would be the favorite way of dying. Are fungi, bacteria, and viruses considered life form? Killing these organisms is considered breaking the first precept. Oh my goodness. That means stop taking your medication, stop taking antibiotics, stop actually wiping the fungus off your... Of course not. What the Buddha said for the first precept, if it's an animal you can see, a breathing being, and you can actually see them with your naked eye, then you should kill them. So if you want to... Because of this, you have to be able to see it. It has to be visible. And then you shouldn't kill it. So if you do really need to swat a mosquito, please take your glasses off first. I shouldn't say that. No, you didn't hear that, okay. Do we need, so you can actually clear these things, viruses, bacteria, fungi, no problem. Do we need an immature jhana to be in stream entry or vice versa? That's a good question. We still, people argue over that. As far as I'm concerned, I think you do. But as other people say, you don't. So whatever, whether it's true or not, you need a jhana to become a stream winner. It certainly helps. Everyone agrees on that. But you certainly do need a jhana to be a once returner or, sorry, a non-returner or arahat. That is very clear. That's in the Maha Molunkya Putta Sutta number 64, the Majjhima Nikaya, where it says specifically, you can't even be an anagami, a non-returner, let alone an arahat without jhana, no more than you can reach the pith of a tree without going through the bark. You have to go through the bark and the sapwood to get the pith, the same way you need jhanas to get, or at least non-returner. Today I saw someone kill an ant, purposely using the finger. They couldn't, they had to have the glasses off probably. I guess she did it unconsciously as a habit. Poor ant, poor meditator. It's so hard to change habit in just 10 days. In Mahayana, is there any ceremony to make more people keep 5 precepts after the retreat? Maybe we can do this on Saturday. Ceremonies remind people of what they should be doing. But the really way to keep the 5 precepts is not through ceremonies, it's actually just understanding in your heart. So that's why, you know, you all heard my story. I started as a Buddhist, and I started meditating early on as a Buddhist. And just when I went to the Thai temple, I've been going there for such a long time, one of the monks came up to me and said, "You've been coming here long enough, it's time you took the five precepts." I said, "What are the five precepts?" No one's told me about these five precepts before. And he said, "It's not killing any animal." I said, "Look, I'm a vegetarian, I don't kill any animals. What's the second one?" "Not stealing, I don't steal." I used to, on the London buses, think that if the conductor never asked for the fare, I didn't need to pay it. But now I didn't feel that was right, because I was becoming more sensitive in my meditation. So even if the conductor never asked for the money, I would still pay him anyway. And I said, "I was that honest, I wouldn't steal, not to commit adultery, I wouldn't do that to my girlfriend. You know, I loved her, I cared for her. You know, she's my girlfriend, that's it, I'm not going to play with anyone else. And I wouldn't want my girlfriend to have another boyfriend." That made no sense to me. So yeah, I wasn't committing adultery, not lying, and I was actually very truthful. You know, because I realized, I felt terrible if I ever told a lie. I was deceiving a friend, or deceiving my parents, or my mother by that time, because my father was dead. I just couldn't do that. You couldn't lie to your mum. So I said, "I don't lie." And alcohol, I'd already given that up. And I said to the monk, "I'm already keeping the five precepts. Why do I need to take them?" And I walked away. I never ever took the five precepts, because I was keeping them all the time. Which is more important, to keep the precepts or to take them? That's why so many people do the ceremonies. They take the five precepts, but they don't keep them. And as a monk, I'm fed up with giving the five precepts when people don't keep them. So just you keep them. And that's the very best. "Regarding the amulets, what shall we do with them? It was given to me. How do we let go in a respectful way? Thank you, Metta." Well, sometimes they have these stupa ceremonies, you put them in the stupa, or they get melted down to make a Buddha, whatever it is, and people like doing that. But, you know, they will not protect you. If it's a amulet with a little Buddha on it, it will remind you you're a Buddhist. That is very helpful, in the same way that people have little crosses on them to remind them they're a Christian. I remember this story of this guy. He had a son, and the son was never doing well at school, especially in maths. He was terrible in maths. So his father got him a tutor, and the tutor couldn't help the kid. The kid was still really bad at maths. And without doing well at maths, it's really hard to actually succeed in life. You know, maths is one of those core subjects you have to do well in. So he sent him to a private school. That didn't work. And in the end, he sent him to a Christian school, to a Catholic school. And 1 week after he went to the Catholic school, his grades started to improve. And after a month, he was almost top of the class in maths. And his father was so impressed, he asked his son, "How come, going to the Catholic school, you've done so well? Was it because the teachers are better teachers?" He said, no, they're probably even worse than the Buddhist school. "Was it because of the discipline?" He said, no, that was not the reason why. "How come you went to the Catholic school and you started doing so well?" And the kid said, "Dad, when I first went into that Catholic school and I saw that image of a boy nailed to the plus sign, I thought they're really serious about maths in this school." Okay, that's not putting down Christians on other Christians, but that's a superstition people have. So please get rid of the amulets, dear Ajahn. I had experienced at times very bright nimittas, great, that become so brilliant, white like the sun, excellent, that it envelops a whole space. It lasts for a long time, maybe 10 minutes or more, that I would feel the heat. Is it okay? Great. Do I need to do anything to reduce the discomfort? Discomfort? Was relief the earlier, Ajahn mentioned that cannot go blind because of the intensity of the light. Was worried that it could cause a change to the cells of the skin and eyes by the intensity. As Ajahn mentioned, it is the mind, so can the heat be in the mind as well? Exactly. It's just the way you perceive these things. You perceive light, you perceive heat. You know, it's nothing there at all. By that time, it's just a mind object. Just let it be, and just let it calm down and get more intense. See, it actually works. People do get nimittas, and they're brilliant, and they're wonderful. They do wonderful things for you. I never ever mentioned yet, I think I have time, the health benefits of these things. Because by the time you get to the nimitta stage, you're getting huge amounts of energy coming up, and it's amazing, just in my own experience, to see the health benefits of these things. And I'm not joking, cancers go. One of the best, I was telling this to someone during the interview time, one of the most obvious and amazing results was this guy who came to one of my retreats in Perth, who had an extreme case of psoriasis, this rash which was all over his body, and he came wearing a rubber face mask. He really looked weird. And he came to check in with me before the retreat to say that this rash covered his whole body. You know, he opened up his shirt and lifted his trousers. And he said he was in constant torment from this rash. And he rolled the face mask to stop him scratching his skin off. And he said that he tried all things, doctors, psychologists, nothing was working. This was trying if meditation would work. But he came out to me to say, if I don't last the first day, it's nothing to do with your teaching. This is agony. And, you know, even I always say that in Guantanamo Bay, they let you rest at night. If you have a rash like that, you've got 24 hours torment. It's driving him crazy. He lasted that retreat. And when he came to see me before the retreat with a huge smile on his clear face, it had gone. Except he said, he lifted up his shirt, see, it's not there anymore, remember? And it was there. And it really disgusted me, because realizing just how much torment this guy was on. And this was a tiny band around his ankles. And that looked bad enough. He said, look, that is nothing compared to what I had 9 days ago. Thank you so much. You know, you'd actually freed him of being tortured by this terrible rash. And that was not something which he just said. You could see it. So sometimes this meditation, the health benefits are huge. So if that actually happens, well done. If you have any sicknesses, that's going to be blasted away. So just get in there. Don't be afraid. It's a wonderful little thing. Next question, from wonderful things to mundane things. Is checking my Facebook account on my friend's latest updates considered as breaking one of the 8 precepts? And it's stupidity, but it's not breaking the 8 precepts. Look, the world is not going to miss you for 9 days. You are not that important. You're not the Prime Minister of Malaysia. That you don't check your friend's Facebook and they don't check yours is not going to cause you a ruining of your social life. In fact, people are going to be really interested in you. Why you're not on Facebook for 9 days? It'll make you more popular. You become mysterious. So no, don't check your Facebook for good. No, I've got a Facebook site. I've never seen it once. Somebody else did it for me. I haven't got a clue what it says on there. Hope it's something nice. Is it nice on there, or is it just terrible? Oh, very good. At the start of the retreat, we were told that a lady cannot be in the same room as a monk alone. So during the interview, another man will be in the room. It is said that this is to protect the lady. Protect the lady? I am... I'm not dangerous. Does this mean that the monk cannot be trusted? The announcement seemed to want to create fear. Why not base trust in this retreat? If we are so concerned of a man's and monk's desires going haywire, another method should be imposed on men rather than communicate fear to the ladies. That's a good question. No, you've got nothing to fear from me. I'm a soft, peaceful monk. I've been a monk for over 38 years now. I've got clean record. And there's nothing wrong with you. You're really good men and women. The main reason is to stop malicious people. Because there's so many people who are malicious and they see a monk and a woman in a room together and they're perfectly good talking about meditation, but they spread gossip. You know what gossip is like? Hey, do you know what? I saw Ajahn Brahm. I saw him in a room with a woman, and after she came out, she was smiling all over her face. Yeah, you know what I got in there. So that's the reason we have to have a witness in there. To say, look, he was just teaching Dhamma, he's telling a joke. And that's what it was. It wasn't anything untoward. Because monks, because we're celibate, sometimes, no matter who you are, sometimes you do have enemies. After bhikkhuni ordination, people trying to find fault. So that's sometimes why you have to be really careful as a monk. Because you are celibate, there's a lot of people who have suspicions. For example, my father's favorite joke was, what fun does a monk have? You know this one. Yeah, that's right, you got it. None. What? And that's not true. But because of that, sometimes people think like that. And so because of that, you have to be very, very careful as a monk. And I know sometimes I've almost got myself into big trouble. One of the experiences in my life, which I'm so happy they never had these mobile phones which can take photographs of you. I was teaching in a prison down in the south from Perth. This was in a town called Bunbury. And the only way I could get transport was to take the lunchtime train, free afternoon, and teach in the evening. And one afternoon, I went down to the beach, which was deserted, just to meditate. It's the sort of thing a monk should do. Deserted beach, no one around, so I sat down there. It was very quiet and a wonderful afternoon. Meditated for 2 hours, and when I opened my eyes, this is no joke, there was this drop-dead gorgeous blonde in a bikini sitting next to me on my left. And another one, big-breasted redhead sitting next to me on my right. And I thought, oh my goodness, what's happened? If someone had taken a photograph, I would never, ever be able to explain it. It'd be Ajahn Brahm with his two girlfriends at the beach. It's true. Because what happened, I asked, what are you doing here? What had happened, it was the last day of school, and it was a school maybe a half a kilometer away, and these were the 17-year-olds, they'd done their last exam of school. Now they were free of school, that was the exam to go to university or not. And as soon as they finished their last exam, into their bathers, bikinis, down to the beach to celebrate. And so they'd seen me sitting there alone, really quiet, and they were really interested. And they were sitting next to me, just waiting for me to come out of meditation so they could ask questions about Buddhism. And it was totally innocent and really good. They were really interested, so we had a conversation. I must admit, I did keep it as short as possible. And I was out of there. But they were totally pure-hearted. And that's just what, you know, young 17-year-olds do after they finish school in Australia. They're in the bikinis down to the beach. And it just happened to have an interesting person down there wanted to talk to. But imagine trying to explain that to the newspaper. So that's why we have these things, just to protect you from the suspicions of the malicious. Well, unfortunately, we have to do that. I'm sorry, but there are people who sometimes add one and one together and make three. Or just like to gossip for gossip's sake. So we have to be careful there. So sorry about that, but we have to do that. Can you please explain what are orbs? Okay, you take photographs, especially photographs of holy monks. And you see right in their heart, there's this beautiful smudge of white. And you think, my goodness, that proves that that is a great monk. It doesn't at all. Because they find... I was interested in what these were, and so I went on the internet, Google ORBS, and you'll find many of those orbs appear in pubs in England, in casinos, and probably other places of ill repute too. All they are is dust particles on the front of the camera. They appear on digital cameras, not on the old analog ones, because the flash is moved to the front of the new cameras and it illuminates dust within a few millimeters of the lens. And that was such a big problem that if professional photographers, they have this little, I was told this recently, like a tube you can put on the front of the camera to make sure that the flash doesn't illuminate that area, to get rid of orbs on professional cameras. These are not devas. These are not extraterrestrial beings. It's diffraction pattern from dust. So if you see any monk saying, no, that is a deva light. It is not deva lights, it's dust. You superstitious, gullible lot. That's actually, check it out. No, ORBS, it's only four letters. Google it in and you find all the research has been done exactly what it is. But it's amazing how many people they just want to believe. And so they believe anything these days. So they see a little orb somewhere and say, ah. Oh. Actually, I saw this in Chimpaka Buddhist Lodge. I gave a retreat there once. And a Tibetan monk had been there before me. And had his big picture of him with an orb in the middle and a donation box underneath. That's terrible. Ajahn, if we have a family member who is dying within a short period, weeks and days, as told by the doctors, do we tell the patient so that he or she can prepare himself or herself for better rebirth? Yes. You go to the bank, you get all the money out, put it in two suitcases. No, don't do that. To prepare the patient so that he or she can prepare themselves for better rebirth, or should we not tell so as not to scare him or her? How can he or she prepare spiritually for a better birth? Piece of advice, thank you. Usually when a person is dying, they know. So please, the default position is talk to them and tell them, you're going to die soon, you probably know that. And so they can actually settle their affairs, you can find out what their last wishes are. And also you can actually talk to them about how to die well, to let go. Reassure them that, you know, you will always respect and keep, you know, their wishes intact. Sometimes they wish, look, can please the family please come together. Sometimes mothers and fathers dying, their last wish is any bad feelings or arguments you've had between the brothers and sisters, you reconcile. They just want the family to stay together, live together in peace and harmony, for the sake of the parents. And sometimes you ask them and they give the opportunity to say that. And then they can let go and die peacefully. So it is a very good thing to talk to your family members. They usually know they're going. And then it's so fine. But you know, it's only just, you know, when you know they're going. If you go up to them and start talking to them and say, what do you mean I'm not going yet? Are you trying to get rid of me? Dear Ajahn, have you come across Jin Buddhism? Is that Jin Buddhism? Apparently the centers is very popular and they have prostration, self-healing, etc. They're also famous in Canada. Is that Jin Buddhism? Do they drink gin? I don't know if it's Jin Buddhism. It looks like a G or something Buddhism. I never heard that before, but sometimes people always start new forms of Buddhism. But the one which was started by the Buddha is the one I follow. So the earliest one is the best. Especially one if you have heard about it, and I don't think I have. And even the Mahayana, it's not a new form of Buddhism, okay? It's just the old one. I can feel the power of silence at this retreat. How do we maintain this silence after the event? Unfortunately, you can only keep the silence within. Outside is very noisy. But at least you can feel yourself in a little bubble of silence and preserve that bubble when you leave. So you can always find a little place inside of yourself which is quiet. Even in noise, you can have always like feeling like a bubble. And I'm inside that, and that's silent. Noise is outside, but it doesn't penetrate. Three more questions to go. 10 minutes to go. Deepest appreciation to your guidance of the meditation practice. I must say, even a glimpse taste of Dharma is really, really inspiring. With regards to investment in stock market, sometimes you say nice things about meditation. Investment in stock market, does buying shares of company involved in tobacco or gambling go against the right livelihood? What is the general guidelines on investment for Buddhism view? It usually does go against right livelihood because, you know, tobacco kills people. So it's poison. So you're investing in poisons. And sometimes you may get some money, but what expense when you see how many people die of smoking? And gambling, I made a point in a recent talk which I gave, the difference between gaming and gambling. Somebody explained this to me, it made a lot of sense. Gaming is when you gamble, but you don't expect to win, such as like a raffle for the BGF. You know, they have a raffle, you may be selling something in the BGF, maybe a poster or something, and you raffle it off, you know, 5 ringgit a raffle ticket. You don't expect to win the prize, you do that as a way of doing some donation for a bit of fun. That's called gaming, like a raffle at the school for a prize. You don't expect to win. Gambling is when you really put the money down there, not for charity, you want to win something. That's called gambling. So gaming is no real problem at all. It just makes raising money for charity a bit more fun. But gambling, when you really expect to win and you know you're going to lose, that is the problem. So gaming, if you want to ever do a raffle for the BTF, that's not gambling, that's okay. So you can always, that's why that sometimes we do raffles in our Buddhist Society of West Australia. And the free prize is usually the free haircut from Ajahn Brahm. No one ever takes me up on that. So that's what to do with gaming. But be careful what shares you buy. There are these ethical share companies now you can invest in. And usually they do really, really well. Dear Ajahn Brahm, why Chinese Dhamma monks said if a yogi sleeps during a Dhamma talk, the next life they will become a clam? No. The reason why that people sleep during Dhamma talk is because a monk doesn't know how to teach and talk in public. They make it really boring. I remember when I went to university and I was joining a Buddhist club. We had all these lectures, mostly by professors. They were so boring. I used to go to sleep. Maybe that's because I was tortured as a young man, listening to boring Dhamma talks. That was why I resolved, if ever I become a Dhamma teacher, I would never, ever give a boring Dhamma talk. So it's not the fault of the people listening. It's the fault of the person talking. That's what I say. So, the US today is insolvent. The European Union has massive problems with its banking center. The central banks around the world today are printing massive amounts of money in order to save the economy. As a result, this has created massive inflation to many asset classes. The root of this problem started from financial engineered products in the banking sector. Often these products are high risk and promise high returns, but in fact the odds are always against the customers. Oh my goodness, the world is finishing. Oh! Now that is how to ensure people don't fall asleep and get reborn as clams. Out of compassion for you, so we don't get more clams, I make the talk interesting. So anyway, one, if I'm currently working in this field, is this wrong? Okay, the odds are against the customers. I know sometimes you need to invest, and if you're in that business of looking after investors, be honest with them, say what you think the risks are, and just sometimes people do make money. You have to invest somewhere. This has provided a good life for my family, and this is a form of cheating or stealing. Again, it's not a form of cheating or stealing. It's not wrong livelihood. It's how you do that. So if you really are doing a service, you're using your wisdom and knowledge and expertise to help other people invest, and you really are trying your best and thinking, well, now this is the stocks which I would invest in, and you really would invest in those stocks, then that's fine. You're sharing that information with others. And they know that, you know, there's always a lot of uncertainty in the stock market. So my advice is, the stock market is always uncertain, but the good karma market always will give you great returns. So don't forget to invest in the donation boxes. There you are guaranteed good returns. The stock market, the karma stock market, never crashes. So, but yeah, you have to invest. So please invest wisely. And if you are a person guiding other people investing, please tell them just what you think is good stocks, ethical stocks, in companies which will probably make a profit, but in a very good way. They won't get maybe the best returns, or quick returns, but long-term returns. But I really don't know what I'm talking about, because I'm not a stock market. But nevertheless, if you ask me a question, I will say something about it. So hopefully you enjoyed. That was the last question for this evening on the stock market. Don't know why you ask questions on that. But nevertheless, hopefully you enjoyed this evening's Dharma talk. And now we have the three... Oh no, do the sharing of merit first of all. For all the beings. Idam henya tinang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idam menya tinang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idam menya tinang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. Okay, good night everyone. Have a nice sleep so you don't have to snore tomorrow. And for those of you on a meditation retreat, please have a nice quiet time. And please also be careful when you come in and go out. So if there's people meditating, you don't make a noise. Very good. Okay, see you tomorrow.